KVOO Portland, 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area, and all over the world at KVOO.FM.
Why have anti-gun Americans joined the wave of new gun owners? I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
What's going on?
He's not breathing.
Can you get a pulse?
Barely.
Call a code.
Get an ambu back from the nurse's station.
Heart's still working, means synapses are still firing. We just need to get a message through.
The guy who really founded that connection between Israel and the evangelicals was Bibi Netanyahu.
There's not going to be a war by Russia to conquer the United States. There's not going to be a war by China to conquer the United States. No country is going to conquer the United States. The United States is destroying itself because of the size of its military.
So yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy, and that people don't feel that they can do very much.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
Many years ago, a local Unitarian minister told me, Bert, there's only two things that really motivate people in politics, fear and reassurance. Never mind that being afraid can actually increase the risk of something bad happening. Fear is uniquely powerful. And as our guest Mark Fisher writes in his recent Washington Post article, in blue cities and red suburbs alike, firearms purchases soared last year to the highest level in half a century. It seems that since the pandemic loosened its grip, there has been more and more violence in our streets. After the recent shooting outside Nationals Park in Washington, D.C., former President Donald Trump issued a statement from his Save America PAC calling out Democrat-run cities becoming overcome by violence and lawlessness, and he rebuked the Biden administration for, quote, failing the American people. End of quote. Of course, Trump has been a master at manipulating fear. Fear of the other, or immigrants, or even of normal American Democrats. In his article, Mark Fisher quotes Mark Oliva, folks spokesperson for the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which tracks the numbers. It really was a perfect storm of concerns, he said, that drove sales. In his article titled Fear on Top of Fear, Why Anti-Gun Americans Joined the Wave of New Gun Ownership. Let's face it, fear makes us do crazy things. When people find themselves afraid, we tend to not make wise decisions. So more guns in an already gun-heavy America. And it's people who have been anti-gun buying the new guns. Fisher explains that the factors of the pandemic, police violence, calls to defund police fueled the surge of first-time buyers. Mark Fisher, thanks so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
It's good to be with you.
Mark Fisher is senior editor at the Washington Post. He writes about many things, enterprise editor, local columnist, and Berlin bureau chief. He's covered politics, education, pop culture, and much else in three decades on the Metro, Style, National, and Foreign desks. Join us for the discussion. What is happening? Why is it happening? What can be done? Or is the horse already out of the barn and there's nothing that can be done? Well, again, thanks for being with us, Mark. You write about many things for the Washington Post. I haven't seen this specific topic addressed elsewhere. What stimulated you to write this article?
Well, it's a good question. I noticed that there had been a significant increase in gun sales last year in 2020. And on the one hand, you can imagine that would be the case, given what upheaval we saw in this country last year from the George Floyd killing and the aftermath of the violence that we saw in many American cities, to just the general disruption caused by the lockdown. There were food shortages, all kinds of grocery shortages early on in the COVID pandemic. And so that kind of disruption creates exactly what you were talking about, the fear that often drives people to buy buy guns, in addition to which it was a presidential election year. And that is often, in fact, every time in recent decades that we've had a Democrat elected, there's been tremendous fear among gun owners that the Democrats are going to tamp down on access to guns or even confiscate guns. And as a result, you see a rush to the gun stores to stock up. But that's not what we saw this past year. What we saw was a development of the gun buying pool of people so that it extended beyond those longtime supporters of Second Amendment rights to reach people who had been previously opposed to gun ownership. And that's what got me interested in this story. Here we had at least in the early statistics, we were seeing an expansion of the pool of gun buyers to include a broader selection of Americans, including many people who had real misgivings about whether it's the right thing to own a firearm. That struck me as an important story, and so we set out to go across the country, look at a lot of different people, talk to people who had bought guns for the first time, and profile them in this article to give readers a sense of who it is who make up the new gun buyers in our country.
Yeah, it is kind of a surprise given how, you know, around the world, I can't help but think that when people think of America and Americans, they think of guns. We have so many guns. There have been so many massacres. And for people who've been against this to be the gun buyers now, boy, that does say a lot. And it's really worth looking into for our future. So let's look at some of the factors unique about this moment relative to the surge in gun sales. The pandemic, it kept people in lockdown for many months. Businesses were shuttered. Downtown streets and shopping areas were left empty. Now America is opening up again, and one might not have thought this turn of events would in any way contribute to increased gun sales. But what was it about that bizarre, totally unexpected phenomenon? According to gun dealers and buyers with whom you spoke, how did that actually drive people to decide to buy a gun? In what ways, as Mark Oliver calls it, a perfect storm?
Well, you had people from various different political perspectives heading out to buy guns because of fear, because their lives had been deeply disrupted. So you had people who were predisposed to worry about crime in cities. And they saw last summer just the endless television coverage of violence in the streets occurring in the wake of demonstrations against police brutality and protesting the killing of George Floyd. So you had people on the right who were going out and buying more guns because they saw cities in flames, and they said, this is a danger to perhaps me, my business, my home, my family. So that's kind of an expected result. The less expected result was, as you say, the people who had opposed gun ownership who went out and did the very same thing. Well, they had a lot of the same fears. They saw this disruption in their cities, and while they often agreed, in fact, we talked to a number of people who were out there peacefully protesting against police violence, who nonetheless went out and bought firearms because they saw that the police in their communities were either redirected to the downtowns where the demonstrations were, and therefore their own neighborhoods were left unprotected, or they saw the tremendous antagonism toward the police and the resulting decrease in police patrols. We saw many police departments across the country reporting huge increases in the number of police officers who were quitting, just outright resigning because they didn't want to deal with all this. And so people began to feel unprotected. They began to feel, many of them told us that if they thought if they had occasion to call 911, they weren't sure if the police would come, or certainly wouldn't come quickly. And so that drove them to make that decision to arm themselves for protection of their families. So, you know, it's the fear, it's the disruption, and it's the sense of insecurity, I think, and along with what we've seen as a tremendous decline in trust in our society, in basic institutions. So you put all of that together and you get a feeling among many people that, yeah, I've never liked guns, I've never wanted to own one, I even opposed it, but now I need to do something.
That's very, very difficult for any politician or government to deal with. If you know, if it, this fear that's being manipulated and the lack of trust in basic institutions. That's a big thing. It really is. And the surge in gun buying is it seems like just a sample of that. And that it's, you know, that lack of trust, decline in trust. Is a really big situation that kind of covers a lot of ground in America right now. Your thoughts on that?
Well, absolutely. I think that's at the core of a lot of what we're seeing in the political and social polarization that has redefined our country in so many ways in the last decade or more. And so we've seen a tremendous decrease in trust in every institution from religion to the news media to obviously politicians, but this extends often to private businesses, and now even in some ways to police. Now, police do rank pretty high on any polling that you see on what people trust. Mm-hmm. Not as high as the military, but nonetheless pretty high. And so when we started to see calls for defunding the police, and we started to see police officers themselves pulling back from patrols or even quitting their jobs, trust is really something that is quite easy to lose and very hard to regain. Mm-hmm. And it's not something you can quantify, really. You can do polling about it, but that doesn't really get at that sense in people's guts that they need to do something, that they need to move out of a community, that they need to protect themselves. All of those decisions that people make about where they live and how they live are based on a very emotional, intimate kind of sense that they have about what's going on around them. And you know, social scientists have tried for decades to quantify that. It's very difficult to do. But when you ask people in interviews about what worries them, about what they're confident about, what they think is going to happen, you get a sense when people are scared. And this is a country that has been pretty scared, especially in the middle class, for some time now. We've seen that in our politics. Certainly the elections of both Barack Obama and Donald Trump gave us a strong sense that this was a country that was filled with people who were frustrated, who believed that the system was not working for them, and whose trust in institutions had dramatically declined. And so they were willing to take chances on two very unlikely presidents. And so we see that in many aspects of our society. And what people turn to in those moments, they might take a flyer on an Obama or a Trump, take a chance, let's try this, maybe this will fix things. But they're also looking for things that they know will be secure. And that's where the police come into play. That's supposed to be a rock-solid part of how we design and organize our lives and our communities. And when that is shaken the way it has been in the last year, that leads to some of these decisions that people say, well, I've got to take matters into my own hands.
Right. Boy, that sounds like a recipe for chaos, really. I mean, people like, you know, my neighborhood is safe. People want to feel like their neighborhood is safe. They know their neighbors, and they feel like they are part of a community. And when that trust in that, you know, basic structure that we've all longed for and has kind of been there. I mean, you look back to the 50s, the days of Eisenhower. I don't think there was as much of the concern about that. But you know, back then, racism was just swept aside, and police killings of black people happened, but they weren't recorded on iPhones. And now we see it. And the police murder of George Floyd shook up the entire world. And since many Americans clearly agree that Black Lives Matter, and the summer of 2020, people got out in the streets and said so in city after city. What about that made people like Shakima Thomas, a social worker in Newark, what made her feel afraid? And tell us about who she is and what were some of the factors that, pardon the expression, triggered her to feel unsafe and buy a gun.
She is certainly one of the more unlikely gun buyers we spoke with in the research for this article on first-time gun buyers. Shakia Thomas is a social worker in New Jersey, in Newark, New Jersey, and so obviously she has grown up in a city that's had a long struggle with crime and violence, and she nonetheless, or perhaps because of that, she had never wanted anything to do with guns. In fact, her family was accustomed to guns. She had several relatives who'd been in the military who owned guns, but she, as a lifelong Democrat, a liberal who worked as a social worker, she wanted nothing to do with it. And she, you know, she told us about her experience even back 4 or 5 years ago when Trump was running for president, and she remembered that that time he boasted that he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and he'd lose none of his support. Well, that got her to thinking that there were people out there who might take his comments to heart, mm-hmm. and might take his behavior at rallies to heart and come after folks like her. And she was afraid that the country was headed toward a kind of a violent explosion. So she got a gun permit back then, but she didn't actually buy a gun until last summer. And last summer she actually took part in those protests mm-hmm. after the George Floyd killing, and yet at the same time, she walked into a gun store and bought an AR-15, and later a handgun as well. So this is someone who was really torn and was really making a pivot against her own instincts and her own practice. She's involved in politics in Newark. She's someone who probably would lose votes if she ran for office if people knew that she had guns at home. And yet she felt this was something she had to do to feel safe as a black woman, as a woman in a city with a lot of crime, and as a woman in a city where the police are kind of under siege.
Yes, they tend to, I think, feel that. The police do feel that. I mean, the phrase, it was very unfortunate, in my opinion. I can see where it came from, the phrase defund the police. You know, police have had this, they have not been prosecuted for the crimes that they do, the killing of black people. And you've no doubt seen the initial report about the killing of George Floyd. It was total lies. But what were some of the perhaps surprising effects of that phrase, defund the police? I mean, people, the truth behind it, sorry to interrupt, people behind it wanted to shift funding to, I mean, there's so many examples of people who are not mentally stable, who the police deal with violently, and the funding could be used better by other organizations. But that phrase, defund the police, what were the effects of that?
Well, it's had tremendous effects on our politics nationally and in many communities across the country. Certainly the many conservatives and Republicans picked up on it very quickly, realized that it was potentially a devastating weapon to use against Democratic candidates, because it fed the notion that Republicans have pushed for a long time, that Democrats are soft on crime, that they're unwilling to face the dysfunction in some communities that leads to violent crime. And so it had the desired effect for them politically. It also scared a lot of police officers and emboldened a lot of police unions to lash out. Say, look, our officers are not being supported, and therefore, you know, some officers have decided to quit the force or perhaps ease back on their enforcement of laws, not be quite as aggressive in enforcing laws. And so that began this sort of vicious cycle of police pulling back, crime rising. We had tremendous increases in homicides and across the country in big cities and small over the past year, still nowhere near the levels that we saw back in the 1990s, but nonetheless a big increase over what we'd seen in more recent years. So it's had a big impact as a slogan for both sides, and we've seen Democrats split. We've seen Democrats on more moderate Democrats like President Biden, who has a long history, as does Vice President Harris, of being tough on crime. middle and say, hey, defund the police doesn't mean you're going to be unprotected, doesn't mean we want to cut the number of officers. Trying to get rid of the use of that phrase, and yet we have people on the left of the Democratic Party saying, yeah, we do mean what we say. We do want to shift those funds from police departments to social services to send officers out, not necessarily to send officers out when there's a nonviolent call, but rather to send out some people who are trained psychologists, social workers, people like that. Well, there are cities that have tried some of that, and there are cities where some of those programs work okay, but there are no cities where anyone has found that you reduce crime by reducing the number of police officers. That hasn't been proven as an effective strategy anywhere, and yet that's what's happening in a number of cities.
For those who may have just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're talking with Washington Post writer Mark Fisher about an article he wrote, Fear on Top of Fear, Why Anti-Gun Americans Joined the Wave of New Gun Owners. There's pretty much a lot of people know that a lot of people who hadn't had guns, who are opposed to guns, are buying them up. And one of the things I've learned through the years about history is that we never learn from history. Michael Dukakis warned that about looking soft on crime. He gave them, back in his 1988 campaign, a gift when he looked soft on crime. And we just, it's so easy to simplify things. It's hard to, as H.L. Mencken said, to every complex problem, there's a simple solution, and it's wrong. And people still do it anyway. And we talked about, you know, psychology and therapy and counselors helping people. Psychological therapy is a rather unscientific practice. There are bartenders that practice psychotherapy with varying degrees of success. You spoke with an unlikely therapist, Michael Cargill, owner of Central Texas Gunworks of Austin, Texas. You quote him as saying, "My instructors and I became like gun therapists for people who never had guns or really didn't like guns. One lady came in here in tears with her teenager. She said, 'This goes against everything I believe in, but I need my family to learn how to protect themselves,'" end of quote. Neither bartenders nor gun dealers can be sued for malpractice. What are your thoughts on his version of therapy?
Well, he wouldn't claim to be a licensed counselor, but he's not the only gun dealer who told us about having to have those conversations with people who came into their shops and were really torn and felt that they were compelled to buy a firearm to protect themselves, their families, yet they felt they were betraying their own positions, perhaps their parents, the way they were brought up, and their community, and the people who are on their side politically. So this was a really tough hurdle for a lot of people to get over, yet they were getting over it in a gun store. So they'd obviously made a decision, and yet even as they began the training to use their newly acquired weapon properly, they very much wanted to be talked into understanding that this was a safe thing to do, and that this wasn't going to so to speak backfire on them. And of course that is one of the big responses we got to this article was from people saying, you know, these folks may have made a decision out of fear and gone out and bought their first weapon, but the people most likely to die from the use of those weapons is themselves, because that's just the statistical fact that weapons, gun injuries and deaths in this country are more often the result of people's guns being used against themselves and their families than against an intruder or other criminal.
Oh, it's so true, and yet, again, you know, if you own a gun, you're in your house, you're in more danger, actually. Yeah, statistics show that the gun is more likely to be used against you, or, you know, misfiring or shooting in there. I mean, you know, when people suggest the teachers carry guns, well, there's a little thing called crossfire in a classroom full of young kids. You know, it's an easy reaction. Oh, you know, the bad guys come in and kill kids, so give the teachers weapons. But it's more complicated than that. And And I would think that, as with most, many anyway, personal insecurities, giving in to the fear, letting the fear have power over the individual, as opposed to the individual working on having power over the fear, only exacerbates the problem. Any thoughts as to what a real therapist might suggest to the patient to overcome the fear? And how much do you think this sort of therapy that we spoke about plays into the growing wave of gun purchases?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily encouraging more gun purchases. I think it's making people who've already decided to buy a gun feel a little bit better about their decisions that they have misgivings about. I don't think any amount of kindly words from gun dealers is going to persuade the majority of the people in the country who do not own guns and do not want to own guns. It's not going to persuade them to do so.
Mm-hmm.
But for those who have already made that decision, they're looking for not only guidance and technical training in how to shoot and take care of their firearms, they're also looking for someone to tell them, you've made an okay decision.
Mm-hmm.
You're not a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
A number of the people we spoke to who were first-time gun buyers did say that they continued to be haunted by the feeling that maybe they made the wrong decision, and they were looking for some kind of validation from whether it was the retail clerk or the gun instructor or others around them. In fact, a number of the people we spoke to have joined gun owner groups and have kind of found a new social life from their fellow gun owners who go out and train together and go out and perhaps sometimes hunt together, sometimes just go out to the range, several of them said this is it's like a whole new world that they've found, and especially in a very lonely time like we've gone through as a country through the pandemic, that's a significant boost for a lot of people.
No question about it. People want to feel connected, and I think this country in general, people feel kind of disconnected being at their desks and at their computers. But certainly, the pandemic made it a lot worse. As I said earlier, there's a fear and reassurance, and it sounds like the people who, this is overgeneralization, but they go into a gun shop fearful, and the gun therapist reassures them, yeah, you're doing the right thing. You're doing the right thing. So fear and reassurance, again, two of the biggest politically motivating factors there are. One of the things that conservatives talk about is prayer in classrooms. Prayer in classrooms arises from students' genuine fear of not doing well. The term creative insecurity has been used to justify, accept, and find a proper place for this kind of fear. Fear is also used in industrial relations. Writing in Industry Week, John Dyer has a different angle. He said his boss told him, quote, fear is a good thing. Every employee should come to work every day afraid of the competition and afraid of being fired. Fear is a great motivator, end of quote. And Dyer responds, writing, fear can have a devastating effect on an organization's ability to make improvement happen. I did a story on working conditions a while ago at Amazon. Fear from above rules the warehouses. It's a very, top down, you better cover yourself, you're being watched every second of the day. It's very good for the immediate bottom line, but in the longer run, as John Dyer observed, fear locks things in place and inhibits ability to make improvements happen. How does fear, do you think, constrain improvements in business, for example?
Well, certainly I think it's clear that creativity and imagination require a certain kind of freedom, people who want to be free not to fail. It's interesting that Amazon is an interesting example of both of these phenomena. Certainly the warehouse workers who have a very regimented work life in which there's not a lot of room for breaking out of the patterns. They are sort of classic industrial workers, and so they do report being under a lot of fear that if they get something wrong, if they slow down, they're going to be fired. On the other hand, in Amazon's corporate offices, there seems to be a philosophy
two-tiered?
So, unfortunately, two-tiered. We have a very much class-divided system in this country and perhaps elsewhere when it comes to the use of fear. But we are all subject to fear on the streets and in our cities and neighborhoods, and that's something that cuts across class lines, and that's why we're seeing this increase in the percentage of Americans who have decided to own firearms. And it's the first really significant increase in that number in decades. We're seeing the percentage of Americans who own guns going up from roughly 30% to roughly 40%. Right. That's a very significant increase in a very short time. Nonetheless, it is a minority of the country and remains so. And we have huge majorities of the country that want to see further restrictions on gun ownership and the ability to get a gun, particularly if you're someone with either mental health issues or a criminal record. But nonetheless, there has been a significant change in people's attitudes toward gun ownership over this traumatic period that the country has been through.
Well, there certainly has. And again, for those who may have just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're speaking about anti-gun people buying guns, a lot of guns. Our guest is Mark Fisher, who writes for the Washington Post, covering many different topics. And I wonder about there's a lot of people, moderates, liberals, people on the left, have felt like there's the gun nuts out there. These people who seem to worship their guns, they sleep with their guns, they see guns not just as symbolizing freedom, but actually being freedom. That gun ownership and freedom are the same thing. My guess is, and you spoke to a lot of people who are new gun buyers, that's not the case for this new large crowd of people that are that had been anti-gun that are now buying guns.
Yeah, this is a much more sheepish, perhaps reserved group of gun buyers. They're people who, for the most part, had been opposed to guns or just didn't have strong feelings about guns, and so they're a little bit questioning about whether this is the right move. So they're less likely to be out there demonstrating for Second Amendment rights. And politically, they tend to be liberal or democratic. A good number of them are also from groups that may not feel entirely welcome in an NRA kind of gun supporter crowd. There's a significant percentage of the new gun buyers who are blacks, Hispanics, other minorities, also quite a number who are gay or transgender, and so we're seeing that quite a number of the gun shop owners we talked to said that they're seeing all kinds of people coming into their shops over this past year who they never saw before, that their clientele had previously been mostly white guys, and that has changed. So yes, there's a different kind of attitude that the new buyers bring to gun ownership, and it's unlikely, it seems to me, that they would be joining in the kind of Second Amendment protests that we see across the country of people showing up at state houses with their AR-15s.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that does seem like a big, significant difference. And in terms of fear, I would be less afraid of new gun owners who are there for protection. I think they're putting themselves at great risk, but that's not my choice. Whereas, the NRA is not likely to pick up strength now. They've been dying for a while. A lot of their corruption and misuse of funding, I don't see that happening. But as you saw, people feel like they're connected. They've connected with other people who also felt scared, and that's, people want to feel connected. And another thing, politically, authoritarians depend on fear. They thrive on fear. They have to have fear. I mean, you look at authoritarians anywhere in history of the world, fear kept them in power. But as with businesses, a republic is supposed to function for the many, not just the few. This fear that's fueled the surge in gun sales, what are your thoughts on how this might affect the stability of our Republican form of government. This, not just the guns themselves, but the buy-in of fear, the spreading like a cancer of fear across the country. How does that affect our stability?
Well, it certainly affects our politics. Whether it affects our stability, I mean, certainly with the January 6th riots in Washington were evidence that this kind of attitude and this kind of fear can get out of hand very quickly in a very unsettling way. And yet you could also argue that the system held and that the forces that needed to push back against this insurrection were there and did their jobs, and there was indeed a peaceful transfer of power. But I think we're hearing in some of the reporting that's coming out just in this recent days, as a number of these new books about the Trump administration and its final days are published, we're seeing an increased level of evidence that that things were very dicey around January 6th, and that there was tremendous fear even among our top military leaders that the government could be toppled, that Trump could pull off a coup. So we can't be overly sanguine, overly confident that that our system will hold under any condition. And certainly the American tradition of gun ownership makes us very different from any other country in this regard, because as you mentioned, authoritarian leaders around the world like to traffic in fear, but they also like to make sure that their opponents are not really a threat to them. And so in almost all authoritarian societies, there's a tremendous pushback against gun ownership, against people who could be a danger to the government being armed. Whereas in our country, we've kind of encouraged that. And certainly Donald Trump encouraged that, although he was personally opposed to gun ownership through most of his life, certainly never owned a gun, has nothing but derision for people who hunt and people who collect guns. He told me in an interview back in 2016 that he thought such people were stupid. Nonetheless, as he became a candidate and then president, he changed his tune rather dramatically to become a vocal supporter of Second Amendment rights and made that a constant theme at all of his rallies. So he recognized that there is in this culture a regard for guns, a love of firearms in some quarters that is an important part of the politics of grievance and the politics of mistrust, and that's what he has fed on throughout his late life political career. So he wasn't he really didn't have the option of standing tall against guns or even seeking moderate gun controls after the Newtown shootings. Or after the, I think it was the Parkland shootings in Florida, Trump came forward and actually did try to embrace some additional gun reforms, gun controls, and immediately backpedaled, and we never heard from him again on that because the blowback that he got from gun supporters who were also Trump supporters was fierce.
For sure, and when it comes to authoritarianism, certainly, you know, the gun lobby said, you know, encourages gun ownership because they say, and it's true, that you can't own a gun. Only the government can have guns in authoritarian countries. And that is one thing that is different here. But then again, people out on the streets not being a part of any militia, as was intended by the Second Amendment, can be a little bit more dangerous. And the importance of guns in political power, you talked about head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, I hope I got his first name right, saying how they can't, the rioters on January 6th, we have the guns, the military has the guns. And that's so that guns are very essential to keeping power. And I had a college professor a long time ago who said that defined politics as the economy of violence. Who has the you know, the authority to have guns? That really does matter. So getting it out there on the streets now and more guns in private hands, it kind of makes me a little bit nervous. going back to another president a long time ago, a different America, when a different president addressed fear, saying, of course, the only thing we have to fear was fear itself. Though the fear that's stimulating the gun sales, the fear on top of fear, as you define it, is rampant, I don't see any people in political power even trying to address it as FDR did. Where are the politicians on the rise of well-armed fear?
Well, I mean, I think there's been a reticence in recent years among Democrats to push for gun control at the level that many of them believe it should be expanded. And certainly there's been a significant lack of follow-through when many Democrats run for office pledging to crack down on guns, and then they get into office and we hear nothing further on that front. That said, they're being realistic because there's been no way to push any of that legislation through Congress because of rock-solid Republican opposition and some opposition among moderate Democrats as well. So we have, you know, in this country, we have obviously a cultural and political divide, and guns have become one of the markers that we use to figure out which side people are on. And that's, you know, obviously unfortunate that the sort of symbolic meaning of guns outweighs the practical need for restrictions in our society. But that's where we are. And it's hard to imagine that getting rolled back, even as we see virtually every other country in the Western world and beyond really restricting gun ownership to a very small number of people for very narrow purposes in their societies. So it's hard to see how we would get there, even though you have large majorities of the country that want to get there. And that's reflective of our political structure, where we, for good reasons, have a society where small populations in states are, their minority rights are protected by our Constitution, and so the people who tend to live in rural states have a lot more political power, and they're able to stop restrictions that would indeed constrict the way that they live, the way that they comport themselves when it comes to guns.
And people really do value freedom. They value personal freedom tremendously here, and I frankly share that. What about the race factor? African Americans have long been subjects of police violence, and nothing's been done about it. In the late 60s, many were tired of it and angry enough to form the Black Panthers, an armed reaction to police violence. Of course, that brought more police violence. You spoke with Karen Williams Ader. I'm not sure I pronounced her last name, a middle-aged Black woman who said she was unnerved by the spate of mass shootings. And she knows that just by being Black, the risk of police violence is greater, and that does concern her. She believes that by having many weapons at home, she feels more peace of mind. She doesn't have to rely on police. According to research on the realities of the situation, what is the reality? Do her guns make her actually safer or just feel safer?
Well, I think it is largely a psychological impact, and in fact, many gun dealers would say so. The gun dealers I spoke with for this story, nearly all said that the overwhelming majority of their customers are never going to use that weapon anywhere except on the range, if that.
Right.
And so it really is a totem of sorts that people hold on to for their own sense of security. And I think in the case of a number of the Black new gun buyers we spoke to, including Karen Williams Ader, this was indeed the case. She doesn't expect to use the gun any time. She doesn't carry it with her. She keeps it at home. If she, like many of the others we spoke to, actually keeps her gun properly locked up, so it wouldn't even be at hand necessarily if someone confronted her in her own home. And yet it gives her peace of mind to know that it's there. She's got, I think, three handguns and a shotgun at this point. And there's a certain element of personal identity and pride that goes into that decision, where she talks about, she told me, I'm not bringing a knife to a gunfight, and people like her, black women, need to be able to defend themselves, she said. So there is, there's a gap between the practical use of a firearm and just the psychological boost of owning it, of having it there in case you need it. In that way, it's like certain medications that a doctor might give you and say, you don't really need to use this, but just have it there in case you have that feeling or whatever it is. And so that kind of doctor's order to just have it as a standby, it's the same kind of sensibility about a gun. It's there not necessarily to be used. And given the staggering number of firearms that are sitting in people's homes in this country, well more than several times the population. There are lots of Americans who have a whole arsenal at home,
yes.
And of course they've never used that. We have way more homicides in this country than we ought to, but it's still something that's measured in the thousands, not in the hundreds of millions, which is the number of weapons that we have.
Yeah, the guns don't, I don't know, it's just, I think that's an interesting point, the psychological boost, because it really doesn't make people safer. So there were the Black Panthers, and the violence that they, protecting themselves, it didn't go real well, to put it mildly. But what about Asian Americans? Trump fanned the flames of racist hate by blaming China for the pandemic. We've seen the tragic results. There's been a lot more violence against Asian Americans. Any idea of whether or not the same gun buying spree is happening in Asian American communities?
We haven't seen any numbers that would indicate a large expansion of gun ownership among Asians. It's hard to know because the number of Asians in the country is not really large enough to poll on this kind of an issue in an accurate sort of way. So we're going with largely anecdotal reports, industry groups, individual gun dealers, and they don't report seeing any enormous boost in the number of Asian Americans who are coming out to buy guns. That said, there may be some increase, but it doesn't seem to be widespread.
That's kind of reassuring, I must say. And you cite Jabril Battle, who's a 28-year-old account representative at a financial services company in Los Angeles, who had always believed that, quote, anyone who had a gun was a gun nut, end of quote. He said, I really bought into the whole idea that more people having guns, the more likely it is for people to start killing each other. How did the pandemic reshape his thinking away from that?
Well, as the pandemic developed and the lockdown happened, and if you remember back, it's only a year ago, and yet it may seem like a distant nightmare. There were real questions in many communities about, is there going to be enough food? We all remember going into those supermarkets and seeing the shelves wiped clean, not just of hand cleanser, but also of certain categories of food. And so he got to worrying about whether if food and water become scarce, that he was going to deal in his own community with what he called a Mad Max situation, like the Walking Dead, but not with the zombies. And so if you have that attitude, if you perceive your world and your neighborhood in that way, then you're thinking in that kind of fantastic Hollywood kind of manner, then it starts to make sense that the people who are going to survive are the ones who armed themselves, who are willing to protect themselves. And so he, the way he put it was, do I want to be the person who has a gun or doesn't have a gun? So he went out and bought a Beretta and then a Glock pistol as well. And yet he was very frank with us and very open about the fact that being a black man in Los Angeles with a gun put him at high risk. So he was totally cognizant that he was in some ways making himself more at risk by getting that gun, and yet he kept imagining the scene of being stopped by a white police officer or any police officer, and having to say, "Yes, I have a gun in my car," and wondering what the reaction of an officer would be. An officer would probably be a little bit freaked out, a little bit scared himself, and so that's a recipe for disaster. And yet, nonetheless, Battle decided that it was more important for him to be armed to protect his home than it was for him to worry about that risk of having the gun in the car when he's out and about in the city. So, you know, a tough calculus, and yet he feels he made the right decision.
And he does have that sense of community now, because he knows other people who have guns. And aside from blacks and Asian Americans, women feel endangered also because of their gender. That's a fact. And you quote a transgender person, Savannah Grace. She said flying a rainbow flag at her home showed that people at her house are activists. She now defines herself as a gun person who hates gun people. What does that say about our topic?
It says that we live in a somewhat confused society that where people act in very contradictory ways. And so here was someone who, Savannah Grace lives in Richmond, Virginia, and she lives in a house with a number of other transgender people and queer couples, and so she's around people who feel threatened. She's also around people who feel that gun ownership is a threat to them. And so here's their friend who goes out and buys herself a Glock handgun and keeps it loaded in her dresser and handles it every day to make sure she's comfortable with it. So that's not going to go over too well among some of her friends. Mm. At the same time, she feels more confident about going out when she knows that she has that gun at home, and she signed up for a concealed carry course through an organization that didn't even exist just mm-hmm. recently, called Armed Trans Women. So this is clearly, you have a somewhat shifting society when you have groups like that who are arming themselves, and it presents an interesting issue for people who are opposed to her politically. People on the right, who are traditionally the defenders of the Second Amendment, mm-hmm. they've always said, we want everybody to be armed. Well, now they're being confronted with the fact that people who they think of as their opponents or even enemies are going out and getting armed. Are they still okay with that? That's probably a good next story to do.
Well, certainly they felt that way about the Black Panthers back in the 60s. Well, we didn't want those people to be armed either. It is interesting. We mentioned that, you know, people imagined Obama was going to take their guns. And I wonder if people feel this about Biden. The question is, did gun sales drop when Trump was president and are just now surging again?
Yes, that happens every time. I mean, that's a dependable statistic that we've seen going back half a century. Whenever Democrats are elected, especially those who have made anti-gun comments in the past or have supported even mild restrictions on gun ownership, you see enormous surges of gun buying in the months prior to the election and then around the election itself. And we saw that with Biden, just as we did with Obama, just as we did with Clinton. And yet Joe Biden is, although he's been committed to gun control measures for his entire career, we haven't seen him make any move in that direction, and learned from people around him that that's not a priority for them because they don't think it's politically practical to make much progress there. But so the gun, I think you'll see in the 2021 gun purchasing numbers that peak we saw last year will come down somewhat. That's been the pattern through most recent administrations. But yes, to answer your question, the gun buying numbers did come down during the Trump years, and because there wasn't that fear being drummed up by some of the conservative media that the Democrats were coming for your guns and go door-to-door confiscating them, which obviously is never going to happen in this country.
That's for sure. And it's amazing to me how the power of fear. Republicans in the 2020 election, they must have done some research to see what would best stimulate fear and rage. They found that, blatantly absurd though it was, saying that the Democrats were engaging in human trafficking, abusing children, was something that was universally feared. I wonder what the results were of this kind of tactic, and if, you know, this, the fact that fear works is likely to increase the use of fear again.
Well, fear does work in politics, and certainly no one party, no one side has a monopoly on it. Yeah. But in our recent history, certainly Republicans have been more savvy about using fear as a political weapon. There's no reason to think they would turn away from that since it's been reasonably successful. I don't see a scenario where either party would wake up one day and say, we're not going to use these kinds of emotions that are clearly effective in getting at people's insecurities and getting them to act politically on those insecurities. If it works, they're going to do it.
Of course. One last question, Mark Fisher of the Washington Post. Do you see any movement away from the surge in gun ownership?
I haven't. There are not yet numbers for this year, 2021, mm-hmm. And so it's statistically, there's no way to say that's what's happening. Just anecdotally, from talking to gun dealers, they say that the major surge that they saw prior to the 2020 election, and then around the time of Biden's inauguration and the insurrection and all of that, that has calmed down, and they're not seeing the kind of almost panicky gun buying that they saw earlier this year and late last year. So, will that hold for the rest of the year? It'll depend, I think, in good measure on what's happening in our country and around the world. As you track people's insecurity and track their mistrust, you probably get a pretty good sense of where gun sales are going.
Mm. Yeah, and pushing for sensible gun laws doesn't seem to work. It's just never caught on. If it didn't happen after, the Newtown massacre of, 30 little kids, I don't know if it'll ever happen. Well, it's been fascinating discussion, Mark Fisher of the Washington Post, and shedding some light into an area that it's been a little bit surprising how people that oppose to guns are the ones buying them up now. Thank you so much for being with us and keeping democracy alive.
Thank you, Bert. Roses, greens, and man-made meat, running out of things to eat. Little boys having way too much fun playing with the big boys' gun. I'm scared for the children. And on the day the last bird dies, there won't be a drop from the big square eyes. An old man with his eyes like glass kisses the last blade of grass. Yeah, I'm scared for the children.
you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.